Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump was engulfed in controversy Sunday after he equated his creation of thousands of jobs as a sacrifice, comparable to the death of a Muslim American soldier who was killed fighting in Iraq. Ghazir Khan, the father of Army Captain Humayun Khan, told CNN that Trump is totally unfit for the leadership of this country. Khan, a Pakistani immigrant, said in an emotional speech at last week's Democratic National Convention that his family would never have been allowed to immigrate to the U.S. under Trump's immigration policies. Trump, in an interview that aired Sunday on ABC News, responded.
Well, I'd say we've had a lot of problems with radical Islamic terrorism. That's what I'd say. We have a lot of problems where you look at San Bernardino, you look at Orlando, you look at the World Trade Center, you look at so many different things. You look at what happened to the priest over the weekend in Paris where his throat was cut, 85-year-old beloved Catholic priest. You look at what happened in Nice, France a couple of weeks ago. I'd say you got to take a look at that because something's going on and it's not good.
Trump's opponent in the November national election, former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, campaigned Saturday in Ohio. At least 13 people have been killed, including seven attackers, in an assault on a Somali police compound in Mogadishu Sunday. Somalia's internal security minister told VOA that the target was the Criminal Investigation Department headquarters. He said at least 10 people were wounded. The spokesman of the Internal Security Ministry of Somalia said the 13 included seven attackers, a government soldier, and five civilians. VOA News. Turkey intensified its crackdown Sunday on officials who allegedly played a role in the failed coup in mid-July, dismissing nearly 1,400 military personnel. Among those discharged was a top aide to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who also moved to tighten his grip over the top ranks of the country's armed forces and spy agency. Erdogan aide-de-camp Ali Yazidji was among those arrested 5 days after the July 15th uprising in an attempt to overthrow Erdogan's Ankara government. More than 50,000 Turks have now lost their jobs across the country, and more than 18,000 have been detained, all for their alleged connection or support of Fethullah Gulen, a Muslim cleric who has lived in the United States for 17 years, that Erdogan has blamed for the coup attempt. Gulen is an Erdogan opponent, but has denied any connection to the upheaval. Iraqi officials say militants have launched two attacks on energy facilities in northern Iraq, killing at least five people. Both assaults Sunday took place inside Kurdish-controlled areas of Kirkuk province. Authorities say in the first attack, about 15 kilometers northwest of Kirkuk, gunmen shot dead four of the gas facility's employees and planted explosive devices around the building. In the second attack at the nearby Bai Hassan oil field, the insurgents, wearing suicide vests, killed an engineer and wounded at least six other people. The militants also sparked a major fire. An international human rights group Sunday demanded authorities in Afghanistan prosecute militia forces linked to a top government official for recent killings and other abuses against civilians in the northern Faryab province. The New York-based Human Rights Watch says that its probe into the late June attack has found members of the Junbish militia loyal to First Vice President Abdul Rashid Dostum were behind the violence. The findings are based on interviews of villagers conducted in the aftermath of the attack. Pope Francis told hundreds of thousands of pilgrims Sunday in Krakow, Poland, to believe in a new humanity that does not use borders as roadblocks and rejects hatred for each other. Francis addressed the congregants who had traveled from all over the world on a large field on the last of his five-day visit to southern Poland. In an acknowledgement to a world dominated by the internet, Francis urged the crowd to download the best link of all, that of a heart which sees and transmits goodness without growing weary. The Pope also told the gathering that the Catholic Church's next World Youth Day will be held in Panama in 2019. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Our reaction is that the United Nations should not give him an audience because he's illegitimate. His nomination was illegal and his appointment was illegal.
The South Sudanese President Salva Kiir names a delegation to meet United Nations officials in New York.
The Security Council has agreed to renew the mandate of the MINUSMA and take into consideration all the demands of the government of Mali, again, thanks to the leadership of the United States.
A Malian top envoy to Washington expresses optimism about the prospect of peace and stability in his country.
We are very happy that the resolution has been passed at the Security Council, and it's a resolution to help Burundi.
And Burundi rejects a decision for a police force by the United Nations Security Council. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Spokesman for the leader of the South Sudan's People's Liberation Movement in opposition, SPLMIO, Dr. Riek Machar, has called on the international community not to engage or acknowledge FARC Vice President Taban Dengai. Taban Dengai was recently appointed by South Sudan's President Salva Kiir to replace Machar as the country's FARC Vice President. But James Gadet Dak told me the peace accord signed between President Kiir and Machar has collapsed following what he says was Kiir's decision to replace Machar with dismissed Mines Minister Taban Dengai.
Our reaction is that the United Nations should not give him an audience because he's illegitimate, his nomination was illegal, and his appointment was illegal. So he should not be given an audience in New York by the United Nations to try to justify his nomination.
Well, in that same token, the second vice president, James Wanaiga, said President Salva Kiir had also charged the SPLMIO leaders in Juba to also meet regional bloc IGAD officials to clear any suspicion triggered by the replacement of Dr. Riek Machar. What is your take on that?
Also, those are not SPLMIO leaders anymore. These are the people who have defected together with Taban Dengai. They are part and parcel of President Salva Kiir's faction. So we don't call them SPLMIO. They are part of the faction led by President Salva Kiir. So what's happening now in Juba is only one party doing everything, that is President Salva Kiir and Taban Dengai plus officials who have defected with him. So let them not speak on behalf of the SPLMIO. If they want to go to New York, let them make it clear to the world before they are welcome to New York that they are a delegation sent by President Salva Kiir. We speak on behalf of President Salva Kiir, but not on behalf of the SPLMIO. And if they try to claim that they are the SPLMIO, then they should not be given an audience by the United Nations in New York.
Well, but these SPLMIO officials in Juba have yet to be officially dismissed from the SPLMIO, and they have been with the SPLMIO for all this while. Even Taban Dengai, who was fired supposedly by Dr. Riek Machar from his position and not necessarily from the party. So what is the confusion here? What is the... There appears to be a disconnect here.
No, Taban Dengai has been dismissed from the party and from his positions in the party. This is very clear. And Dr. Riek Machar confirmed this a few days ago. Also, Taban was withdrawn from his position as Minister of Mining. This was also communicated to President Salva Kiir, who refused to act to remove Taban Dengai from the position of Minister of Mining, which belongs to the SPLMIO. So it is very clear, and Dr. Riek Machar has also directed his officials who are in Juba to boycott, the meetings or not to associate themselves further with Taban Dengai, who is no longer with us. So anyone who will, associate himself with Taban Dengai with directives from President Salva Kiir is no longer a member or official of the SPLMIO. So they should not claim they are SPLM-IO anymore. They should make it clear that they are part of President Salva Kiir's faction. And if they want to go to New York, they are representing Salva Kiir, not representing the SPLM-IO.
So what happens to the implementation of the peace accord signed between President Salva Kiir and Dr. Riek Machar? What happens to it?
Well, it is collapsing. If the situation continues like this, the peace agreement is collapsing because we are at war now. As we speak, fighting is going on now around Juba. They have attacked our positions around Juba for the past number of days. So fighting has been continuing. President Salva Kiir even violated the ceasefire, which they declared on the 11th of July. So there is no peace agreement implementation as we speak. What is going on now is the return to war. The fighting has been going on. And to add it to what is happening, on our part, we have been calling for a deployment of third force in Juba so that the situation can be, corrected. But if that does not happen, then we will be forced to move on to Juba and take control of the capital. So this is the situation we are in now.
Well, Dr. Riek Machar said his forces might move on to the capital, Juba, and take over. Isn't this a call for war, another round of civil war, perhaps?
Well, not a call for war. It is about a war which has been, reimposed on the people of South Sudan by President Salva Kiir. As I said, his forces are now, as we speak, fighting our forces around Juba. They have been on offensive. So it is President Salva Kiir who has again declared war on us, and we are defending ourselves.
James Gadet Dak is the spokesman for Dr. Riek Machar. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The West African nation of Mali is still struggling with violence despite a 2015 agreement aimed at bringing peace. In fact, a new armed organization emerged last month. But Malian ambassador to the United States, Tiana Koulibaly, remains hopeful about the prospect of his country's future. What would you say has been the relationship or is currently the relationship between Bamako and Washington?
The U.S. is very much involved in the health sector, human health sector, is involved in local development. The U.S. Has signed just last year a very, very, very important development program with the USAID. After the rebellion that has occurred in 2012, we have had negotiations in Alger in which the U.S. was again committed. And so during those negotiations, everybody agreed that the North is somehow backwards towards the compared to the South in development basis. And for that reason, the government has decided that it will invest a lot of money in the North so that the North would catch up.
How does that help your government in resolving some of the security challenges that you face in the North?
We have now, I think, 12,500, something like that. So we'll have 2,500 more to make it a total of 15,000 people. The Security Council has agreed to renew the mandate of the MINUSMA and take into consideration all the demands of the government of Mali, again, thanks to the leadership of the United States.
Now, I understand some of these jihadists or mini rebel groups, if I may, were not happy about the extension of the UN mandate and the robust nature of the new mandate, such that during the month of Ramadan, they've been having sporadic attacks here and there. How is your government resolving to combat those kinds of attacks?
The main way for us to fight on our part of the jihadists is to have those joint patrols between the armed forces, platform, and the CMA. But aside of that, of course, we need a bigger contribution of the UN forces. That is what's new in the more robust mission of the MINUSMA.
Let me ask you, is there a government plan to boost business activities, development plans up north.
The president of Mali is very, very committed in the implementation of the peace process. And what he says is that, if Mali lies down $1 and we get 900,999 to complete to $1 million from the international community, still the others are helping us. One of the biggest projects in the north is the dam of Tausa. Today, we have all the funding for the dam. We also have the funding for roads from Gao to Burem. The dam is in Burem, from Gao to Burem, and also from Burem to Kidal. All of that is there. What we're waiting for is just the peace, but the peace is not just the peace, is very, very important.
What do you see the North becoming in the next 5, 10, 15, perhaps 20 years to come?
The North of Mali is the future of Mali, because the North of Mali is very, very huge. It's very, very, we have a very, very big potential for agriculture. We have good land there. We have a very, very big potential for the production of the mines. The north of Mali is rich in underground wealth. And, it is the region in which more development can be. I expect that all the funding, all the funds that have been promised to Mali, when all of that is there, there will be actually a move of the population from the south of Mali to the north, and that the land will be better occupied than it is now.
Tiana Koulibaly is the Malian ambassador to the United States. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The government of Burundi has rejected a decision made by the United Nations Security Council Friday. It calls for the deployment of over 200 police officers to monitor security in the country. For VOA, Moses Havyarimana reports from the Burundian capital, Bujumbura.
The Security Council resolution proposes sending 228 United Nations police officers to Burundi for at least 1 year to monitor the security situation and to help the United Nations Commissioner of Human Rights to monitor violations and abuses in the country. Reuters says the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, said the resolution was not strong enough and that the United Nations police are not empowered to protect civilians. The government of Burundi has also criticized the United Nations decision. Reuters says Burundi had said it would only accept 50 unarmed police, and Bujumbura has called on the French government to respect the country's sovereignty. The mayor of the capital, Freddy Mbonima, was among the thousands of Burundians who marched and protested the Security Council's decision.
We come here to the embassy of France to tell them that Burundi has full peace. We didn't need their help. So France needs so people to come to help them. You know, Burundi help other nations to recover the peace. And France has been attacked many times, so we are looking for if they can ask us to help them. Not now, no, we have full peace.
A resolution drafted by France was passed on Friday after the release of a report critical of human rights violation in the country. Human Rights Watch says members of the ruling party and also its youth wing in Imbonerakure gang-raped women related to opposition members. The Burundi government accused France of involvement in the 1994 genocide in neighboring Rwanda and warned France not to interfere in its own domestic politics.
You know, in the past time, Rwanda has been problem because they are French there, policeman from United, but many people has been killing. So, but they have to discuss with us to find together solution, but not to impose to do it by force. It can't. We are a nation, we are free, and we have our independence, so we can't agree with that.
The French ambassador to Burundi, Gerrit Van Rossum, welcomed the move by the United Nations Security Council to deploy the police.
We are very happy that the resolution has been passed at the Security Council, and it's a resolution to help Burundi. The resolution will be implemented with the cooperation of the Burundian government. The Burundian government will have its say, but we really hope that this message from the international community will be listened to by the Burundian government.
The capital has been relatively calm in recent weeks, though armed men recently targeted three people in the neighborhood where foreigners live in called Bwiza. Burundi has been in crisis ever since President Pierre Nkurunziza decided to run for a third term over a year ago. The opposition said the move was unconstitutional. Since then, more than 500 people have been killed in the attacks said to be linked to the government or by anti-government armed groups. Meanwhile, regionally supported talks have failed to bring peace. Moses Habyarimana, Bujumbura.
Three Mandela Washington Fellows from Zimbabwe who were doing business and leadership studies at the William and Mary University in Virginia graduated alongside 22 other youths from various African countries. And across America, other fellows graduated ahead of their victory lap to Washington for a final summit with President Barack Obama. VOA Zimbabwe Studio 7 reporter Ntungamili Nkomo has more.
Zimbabwean fellows who graduated from the William and Mary University in Virginia yesterday are journalist, filmmaker, and human rights activist Terry Mutswanga, African Union Commission gender consultant Tinashe Mutsonziwa, and Abel Chemura, a lecturer at the Chinoy University of Technology. The three kept their fellowship with speeches at an ideas summit where they emphasized the need for young people to step up the plate and shape their own destinies. Speaking after the ceremony, Mutsonga told Studio 7 the knowledge he has acquired from the six-week fellowship is invaluable. He says while the U.S. has its own dark past in terms of observing human rights, the country is a shining beacon of freedom.
I think I admired how the founding fathers of the United States had a vision to build this country. The likes of Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe, and James Madison. These founding fathers had a vision about 200 years ago. Although they had their bedside of slavery, a history that actually tainted their CV, but they had a vision to build this nation great. The constitution that the United States is using was drafted in 1787, and up to now it still stands. So that's one of the things that I emulate, although they had this dark side of slavery.
Mutsonga says Zimbabwe should do more on human rights, adding the alleged abduction and disappearance of political activist Itai Dzamara does not bode well for the country.
I think the playing field is not fair. We have got constitutions, for instance, in Zimbabwe, we've got one of the best documents, but our government is not willing to grant citizens the right to exercise or to participate in the democratic process through exercising their basic rights that are enshrined in the constitution. So I think we have to improve to know that with a constitution, we can build a nation, we can build societies. What I emulate from here in the United States is that there are systems in place, they actually put checks and balance.
Chinoy lecturer and environmentalist Chemura also says he returns to Zimbabwe next week a better person and a better leader, thanks to the Mandela Washington Fellowship. In his graduation speech, Chemura talked about a coffee project that he is working on, seeking to connect markets with technology. The three fellows will gather in Washington starting Sunday, together with the nearly 1,000 fellows from various African countries who are also graduating today at their institutions of learning. Altogether, there are about 60 fellows from Zimbabwe. I'm Tungamili Nkomo.
The discovery of an antibiotic compound in the nose suggests a great untapped source of the valuable drugs. The search for new antibiotics is vital because the ones we have are losing their effectiveness against many infections. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The quest for new antibiotics got a boost with the recent discovery of leuctinin, a compound found in the nose that fights Staphylococcus aureus, a human bacterium responsible for the superbug MRSA. The CDC says there are 80,000 MRSA cases every year in the United States and that it's responsible for over 10,000 deaths annually. The reason it's so dangerous is because MRSA, which stands for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, has become resistant to many antibiotics. Commonly known as Staph, many people carry the bacterium harmlessly, in addition to billions of other microorganisms in their bodies. But it's an opportunistic pathogen, and if it gets into the bloodstream, S. aureus can quickly overrun the body with a potentially lethal infection. A common site for Staph is in the nose, but researchers reporting in the journal Nature Microbiology discovered that 70% of the population does not carry S. aureus. According to Kim Lewis, director of the Antimicrobial Discovery Center at Northeastern University in Massachusetts.
So if you have leuctinensis in your nose, chances are you're not going to be carrying Staph aureus. So that was the initial finding of that study.
Leuctinin is produced by another Staphylococcus species. It's survival of the fittest on the bacterial scale. Bacteria in our bodies compete for survival just like animals in the wild. And Staphylococcus leuctinensis makes a really odd-looking chain of amino acids scientists have dubbed leuctinin. That keeps S. aureus at bay. But it gets even more interesting. When the scientists were poking around in people's noses, they found that roughly one-third of the population has S. aureus in their noses, but hardly anyone with the S. leuctinensis bacteria had any sign of the potentially harmful Staph bacteria. But a few people had neither bacteria in their noses. That raises the possibility that there are other bacteria in the body that can take out Staph, and that could mean that there are some other antibiotic agents that have yet to be discovered. Lewis, who wrote a commentary in Nature Microbiology on the discovery of leuctinin, says there's a simple reason why researchers are looking high and low for new antibacterial agents.
We want to stay alive. It's a short answer to that question. Pathogens have been acquiring resistance, and that has been spreading. So now pathogens are gaining the upper hand. So we need to sort of get back into the game and figure out other ways to discover new antibiotics.
Lewis says antibiotics, many of which are still in use today, were discovered during the early to middle of the last century, a period known as the Golden Age of Antibiotics. They were derived from compounds found in soil, a rich source of microorganisms. This new research means the human body itself might be the source of the new drugs to keep us healthy. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Next on Let's Talk. Obsession in a relationship. What does it do? Help or hurt the relationship? Join host Sandy Shumari and his guests discussing obsession in a relationship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next on Straight Talk Africa. Political turmoil continues to destabilize the government in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir has sworn in Taban Dengai as the new first vice president. He replaces Riek Machar, whose whereabouts are unknown since he fled Juba 2 weeks ago following fighting between the two men's rival forces. An in-depth discussion on South Sudan on Straight Talk Africa, Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. We'll be right back.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. For that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the Rio Summer Olympics that kick off later this week. Since the modern Olympics began in 1896, over 200 national teams have vied for glory at the Summer and Winter Games. Now, for the first time, a team of refugees is competing as well. The International Olympic Committee selected 10 refugees who will be competing in Rio, forming the first ever refugee Olympic athletics team. They include two Syrian swimmers, two judokas from the Democratic Republic of Congo, a marathoner from Ethiopia, and five middle distance runners from South Sudan. Their participation in the Olympics is a tribute to the courage and perseverance of all refugees in overcoming adversity and building a better future for themselves and their families. That's according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi. The squad representing them in Rio hopes to give the world a glimpse of their resilience and untapped talent. Many of these have had their training in Kenya. And for VOA, Lenny Ravuga visited the Center for Refugees Athletes in Kenya and filed this report.
The phrase Breakfast of Champions has taken on new meaning here at the Tegla Larupe Training Center for Refugee Athletes. Five of these athletes, now munching on a nutritious meal of bread, fruits and tea, will represent refugees around the world at the Rio Games this August. All five originally come from South Sudan. Runner Rose Natike Lokonyen was just 4 years old when her family fled ethnic conflict in the eastern part of the country. She has lived at the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya for the past 16 years. She thinks of her two youngest brothers often. She had to leave them at Kakuma to come here to train.
I hope I'll do well and get some gold or silver as well if I win. Then I really miss my sibling because since we came to Kakuma, we came together with our parents, but they left. Then I stay with them as well. And here, these are my two siblings whom I took them. They are the youngest one, and these are the two boys who are underage, and now I left them alone.
She says there are good days and bad days in training, but she was headstrong from an early age. She remembers her father punishing her for playing soccer.
When I do escape, going to the field, after coming to the field, he do beat me. In fact, I really miss him now because he was just looking after me. So he didn't want me just to participate in any sport, but I insist myself doing that.
The team has a tough training regimen. Every morning, they start with stretching exercises, which last for 45 minutes. Then the team runs for about 2 hours a day. Lokonyen's event is the 800 meters. It may be no accident that the five refugee Olympians that Kenya is hosting will compete in track and field events. This training camp is named after Kenyan marathon runner Tegla Larupe, who holds several world records. Jackson Kemoi is the manager of the Olympians training camp. He is hopeful about the prospects in Rio.
They had good time in our trials, so that's the special thing they have. But another thing, they are also disciplined. They are also disciplined, and that's what we needed most. These are the best guys, and they are persevere in the camp since September last year up to now.
Lokonyen and her teammates had to flee their homes years ago. Now they will run for gold. This is Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi.
Thanks, Lenny. Visa Inc., operator of the world's largest payment network, signed sponsorship deals with all 10 members of the International Olympic Committee's refugee team, essentially becoming their first corporate sponsor. And in football, the Federation of Uganda Football Associations, FUFA, will host the inaugural 2016 CECAFA Women's Challenge Cup in September. The competition will be played in Kampala from September 11th to 24th. Kenya, Tanzania, Sudan, South Sudan, Burundi, Rwanda, Ethiopia, and host Uganda are among the participants. Eritrea, Zanzibar, Somalia, Djibouti, and Zanzibar, the other CECAFA members, are yet to confirm. Namibia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi have requested guest spots. According to media reports, FUFA President Moses Magogo says FUFA is busy hunting for sponsors. Finally, the first leg, second round, Africa Under 17 Cup of Nations Madagascar 2017 takes place next weekend. The semi-finalists of the tournament will qualify for the 2017 FIFA Under 17 World Cup in India. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy. Hey, you are my inene girl. Inene, you are my inene girl. My inene girl. Aye. Now you where I go send you. Because now you where this catastrophe my bread though. Yeah, yeah. I choose you for real love. Me, I go hug you, love you for real, love. Yeah, my sweetie, my honey. If you give me a minute, I will tell you how I'm feeling. Make you no give me story, baby, I am too lonely. I don't go lie, you they make my temperature rise. I want to let you know, I get something for my mind, but now I want to let you know. If I'm with you, no letting go. If I'm with you, no fighting. If I stay with you, my friends, yo, I they promise you no shouting. I do bad, oh, and you are sexy. There is no time, oh, baby, let's get naughty. Me, I no send, oh, wait till they tell me. I try wrong now, what me eat, yo, hey. I don't go lie. They make my temperature rise. Hey, you are my inene girl. Inene, you are my inene girl. My inene girl. I don't go lie. You, they make my temperature rise. Hey, you are my inene girl. Inene, you are my inene girl. My inene girl. I'm so naughty. I'm so naughty. Baby, please can you call me? I'm so naughty. I'm so naughty, naughty. Baby, please can you call me? Can you call me?
check. My money they wait for you, baby. One more time they waste. Make me go to place for real. Oh sweetie, to buy everybody give it a go. To call it all girl in my wogo. Oh, the water bottles on my way. Baby, we can do it your way. Anything you want is okay. All the water bottles on my way. Oh, you Tanzania to Lagos. I go make you famous. Even if they met us. Oh, you go hate us. Tanzania to Lagos. Chako kwangu maradhi matuso none kampo kwangu simanzi ai tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradhi oyani so none kampo kwangu simanzi kwa mahaba ulonipa imenogewa vurugu patashika ai punguza kidogo na mengine kadhalika toto si unanielewa hapo hapo liposhika.
Marie, you. Come on. Let's go.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is fair and legitimate to assert that what is currently happening in South Sudan is a gross embarrassment to the African continent and a bane to the suffering people of South Sudan. Just a few weeks ago, there was a sigh of relief when, after much bloodshed and altercation, the National Unity Government was established with the swearing-in of the first vice president, Riek Machar. The president and the first vice president were in contact. Then just as suddenly, everything fell apart. Fighting resumed. Hundreds of innocent civilians were killed. The forces of Riek Machar were pushed out of Juba, and Riek Machar himself remained in hiding. And when one was wondering what should be done to restore some decency, news appeared that a faction of the SLA in opposition had elected a new vice president, even though that was denounced by the supporters of Riek Machar. But just as suddenly, President Salva Kiir swore in this new vice president, and the forces of Riek Machar again denounced it. And last Friday, we had some news. And the news was that dark forces, that was the words of the spokesman of Riek Machar, were now operating in the Sudan, and that this dark force was not under the control of President Salva Kiir, nor part of the official SLA. Secondly, it was disclosed that President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, though in hiding, were in communication. And then there was a frightening statement by the spokesman of Riek Machar that their tools were capable and ready to march into Juba unless a third force was installed. Now, what is happening in South Sudan is the tip of the iceberg. If you look at the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, here you see the signs of real problem. When the opposition leader, Tshisekedi, appeared last week under huge crowd, the supporters of the president made it clear that the president intends to stay in power beyond its constitutional limit. Look at Burundi. The Security Council last Friday decided to send a meager 200 policemen to help preserve security in the country. The government opposed it, asking for a ridiculous number of 50. Why, you may ask, do African leaders have this dogged determination to control power and to hold on to it to the end? I think the answer may lie in the constitutional architecture that now prevails in most of Africa. I'm referring to this penchant for executive presidency. By itself, it may not be that bad if you have independent and separation of powers. But this is quite seldom in Africa. Only in few countries can you talk about independent legislature or independent judiciary. As a result, you have a all-powerful executive president. But does the president always serve the entire country? In some cases, it may. But more often than not, only a region, a particular ethnic group, may be the main beneficiary. And this is the underlying problem that Africa faces. And there needs to be a solution to this problem. It is, to me, the responsibility of intellectuals, the media, and all men and women of goodwill to recognize this absolute correct fact. the power of the executive presidency has increased, is increasing, and ought to be diminished. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how long a log stays in the water, it doesn't become a crocodile. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Stuart Jones and Iraq's Minister of Trade Salman al-Jumaili signed a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, in mid-July on the purchase and supply of U.S. rice for the Iraqi public distribution system. Millions of Iraqis will benefit from the high-quality and competitively priced rice from the United States. In signing the MOU, the ambassador affirmed the U.S. Embassy's intention to promote awareness of the ministry's rice tenders with U.S. rice suppliers that can best meet the needs of the Iraqi market. This agreement is a positive outcome of the Trade and Investment Framework Agreement between the Government of the United States of America and the Government of the Republic of Iraq concerning the development of trade and investment relations. The MOU will be operative for 6 months, with the possibility of renewal. Ambassador Jones said, "This MOU represents a win-win for Iraq and the United States and is a sign of how our two countries can strengthen commercial ties to the ultimate economic benefit of both our peoples." The ambassador added, "The U.S. Embassy is committed to providing technical assistance to enhance Ministry of Trade officials' expertise with respect to purchasing agricultural products on the international market."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.